Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do the laws and policies that govern activity at polling places protect the integrity of election results, or do they deny voters the right to cast a ballot? Supporters of ID laws and other such measures say their intention is simply to stamp out voter fraud. And as states, including Texas, wrestle with the question of how to prove eligibility for those who turn up at polling places, some critics of the latest round of voter ID laws argue their intention and effect is strikingly similar to the poll taxes and literacy tests that kept many African Americans from voting in the Jim Crow South. Tova Andrea Wang is a senior democracy fellow at Demos and fellow at the Century Foundation. Her new book is The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. Tova, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad to be here.
You're clear from the outset that voting laws have been used and abused at one time or another by pretty much every political party that has existed in America. Before we begin to compare and contrast current arguments for voter reform with those used in the past, would you just give us a little background?
Sure. Well, you know, it's been about 150 years now that the parties have been using election laws to basically disenfranchise the people who they believe will vote for the other side. And so, you know, for the first 100 years of our democracy, it was both the Republicans and the Democrats, of course, being the worst in the South with the Jim Crow laws that you reference, basically eliminating any African-American voting in the South at that time. But starting in the 1960s, when you had the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement, and you had a lot of geographic migration of blacks to the North and whites to the South and the West, you had a realignment that was completed by the 1980s, whereby it was the Republicans who really took sole possession of the vote suppression playbook, because they had now really identifiable groups that tended to overwhelmingly vote for Democrats, African Americans and Latinos, and in more recent years as well, young people. And you've seen sort of attempts at voter suppression ebb and flow throughout the years, but there was a tremendous spike in it these last 2 years since many of the state legislatures around the country got majorities and supermajorities of Republicans taking over and passing these restrictive laws.
So today, an estimated 3 in 10 eligible American voters remain unregistered. What accounts for that other than simple apathy on the part of maybe a minority of those individuals?
Well, I'm so glad that you raised that, because isn't that the real problem in our voting system rather than a lot of the things that you hear being argued about right now with respect to voting rights? The problem is not about, you know, people showing up at the polls and committing fraud. The issue is that we don't have enough people participating in our elections, and at least part of the reason, though I completely accept that there are all sorts of social and cultural challenges that we confront with voter apathy and cynicism, there are structural things in the system that make it more difficult to register, make it more difficult to vote, and I do believe if some of those barriers were lifted and if voting was easier and registering was easier, that you would see an uptick in participation.
What do we know about the frequency of in-person voter fraud in the United States today?
Well, we actually know a lot, because there's been a ton of research on this over the last decade. And there's been academic research, but there's also been research into the number of prosecutions and convictions for voter fraud. And perhaps the most telling statistic out of all of this is that in the Bush administration, as some of us will remember, the Department of Justice during that time was really bent on ferreting out any kind of voter fraud they could find. In fact, maybe some people will remember that there were some U.S. attorneys that were fired for not being aggressive enough in finding fraud in their states. And during that period, from 2002 to 2007, they came up with a grand total of 86 cases of voter fraud. And by the way, none of them were cases of impersonation fraud at the polling place, which is the only type of fraud that would be addressed by something like a voter ID laws. But other huge, huge surveys have been done. Just most recently, a consortium of reporters did an in-depth analysis of over 2,000 cases of voter fraud since 2000 to today. And they found exactly 10 cases of impersonation fraud at the polling place. They did find a few hundred cases of absentee ballot fraud, and they did find a few hundred cases of problems with registration. But it's important to dissect and be precise about what type of voter fraud that you're talking about, because different types of fraud give rise to different kinds of solutions. And so the fact that we do have some absentee ballot fraud tells us that maybe we should be looking at what to do about that. And the fact that we know that we have very little impersonation fraud tells us that something like a voter ID law, while it sounds like it might make some sense, really isn't solving any of the problems we really do have in the election system.
So why are allegations of fraud taking up so much time and energy over the past few years?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, my feeling is that a lot of these claims have been dramatically exaggerated, have been totally blown out of proportion, and there's a motive for that. And that's in order to pass the kind of laws that we've seen passed in the last couple of years that make it more difficult for certain categories of people to vote. If you claim again and again and again all over TV that there's all this voter fraud, and you mix together, you know, these instances of absentee ballot fraud and problems in the registration system, and, you know, ex-felons mistakenly voting, not knowing that they were ineligible, and then they can come up with voter ID laws that we know will inhibit the voting of African-Americans and Latinos disproportionately. They have a justification for it because they've thrown up this boogeyman of voter fraud. But, of course, again, as I said, the type of fraud that we have in the system is not addressed by that kind of a law. So I think it's really ginned up in order to propose laws and propose quote-unquote reforms that will instead exclude certain groups of voters from the polls in order to gain a partisan advantage.
Now, talk about this, because I think there are people who don't have a strong opinion one way or another on this because they think, well, you know, bringing my driver's license is not such a big deal. Talk about why the need for a government-issued picture ID is, in fact, a pretty severe impediment for a certain subset of American voters.
Right. Well, you know, we know that there are a certain percentage of people who don't have the kind of ID that states are requiring, such as the law that was passed in Texas but has since been blocked, a government-issued photo ID, which is most commonly a driver's license. In my opinion, the political leaders who have been pushing these laws know very well that there are, you know, groups that do not have this type of ID. They tend to be lower-income people and therefore often minorities and Latinos who vote for Democrats. But for people who otherwise think to themselves instinctively, and I can understand this, they say to themselves, well, I have ID and everyone I know has ID and I have to use it all the time. I can't understand why this is a big deal. But in fact, there is a huge population of people who don't live that way. They are low-income people who, you know, live paycheck to paycheck, day by day. They don't have cars because they can't afford them, so they don't have driver's licenses. And states saying that they're going to make the IDs free really doesn't solve the problem because as we've seen this implemented in a handful of states, we've seen that you need, well, first of all, you need a birth certificate in order to get the so-called free ID. A lot of people don't have their original birth certificates in their house, and so they have to get a birth certificate, which can cost $22 in Texas to get your birth certificate.
And you have to figure out how to send away for it and that sort of thing if you're living somewhere else.
Yeah, and you have to, right, and that takes a lot of time. And we've also discovered as well that there are a number of places in Texas and elsewhere where there are huge distances between people's homes and the closest DMV. So already we know doesn't have a car and isn't driving to get to the DMV, assuming that, you know, they can somehow find a way to get there, that they can take the time off to stand in line at DMV and, you know, people go that way. And then hope that they have the right underlying documents that they've had to pay for in order to get the card that's supposedly being given for free. I mean, these are huge barriers for, you know, something that is a right that we are all afforded in this country and that, you know, this is part of our democracy. And I think, you know, making it so hard for certain people, I mean, and we've discovered more and more that it's actually elderly and rural people who are really hit by this law because they are not, you know, able to go through these hoops and hurdles and different procedures. So, you know, you have, I think, a real undermining of democracy by intentionally suppressing and making voting difficult for some people. And I think it's, frankly, un-American.
The argument that one party or the other is out to steal an election through fraud has origins as far back as the 19th century. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, these allegations and, you know, the quote-unquote reforms that are being introduced and passed, this is nothing new. One thing that was really fascinating about my research for the politics of voter suppression was seeing, as a voting rights advocate myself, how incredibly similar all the arguments were going back 150 years, 100 years, 50 years ago. Same arguments, same even language being used, just different parties, different, you know, contexts. But this, we've just been going around and around in the same circle for decades. And I think, you know, what I propose in the politics of voter suppression is going towards a more inclusive democracy, one that seeks to increase voter participation through laws and through election reform, not enacting laws that deny the right to vote to certain groups for no legitimate, justifiable reason.
Tova, talk about this. People who characterize this sort of thing as voter suppression see a lot of coded racist messages in these laws. On the other hand, people who say we're just trying to prevent fraud will show you a piece of paper and say there is not a word in here about race, color, or country of origin, creed, anything.
Well, I mean, you know, there's an intent and then there's effect. You know, I don't know how much blatant racism has to do with any of this. What I do know is that African Americans vote 95% for Democrats, and Latinos now vote 2-1 and maybe more this year for Democrats. They did so in 2008 as well. Young people also are increasingly voting for the Democratic Party over the last several election cycle. So that's why I think they're being targeted. I mean, I think most of it is partisan. There is a racial, you know, overtone to all of this that can't be escaped entirely, of course, especially with some of the other kinds of tactics that we've seen, such as these billboards going up in different poor minority neighborhoods with these menacing pictures and talking about how voter fraud is a felony and all this kind of stuff. But the things like voter ID laws and the registration curtailment and the cutbacks on early voting, you know, some of the other tactics that we haven't talked about yet. I mean, there is a racial component to it, but I think a lot of it is just the Republican Party has, for some reason, decided that it is an acceptable and legitimate election strategy, campaign strategy, to exclude some people from voting to try and win the election.
So you mentioned menacing billboards that say voter fraud is a felony. Sometimes there have been also documented cases of rumors being circulated, flyers being thrown out there, emails and phone calls saying,
yeah,
if you have an unpaid traffic ticket or an unpaid parking ticket, which
right,
I think a lot of people have, you will be arrested at the polls.
Yeah, I mean, that was the notorious flyer that was going around in 2004, and it happened a lot in 2004. You would get these flyers in minority neighborhoods, exactly what you said, saying things like, if you haven't paid your parking tickets, you'll be arrested at the polls, or if you haven't paid child support, you'll be arrested. The classic one, especially in the last couple of cycles, has been, you know, if you're a because there's going to be such big turnout, if you're a Republican, you're going to vote on Tuesday, and if you're a Democrat, you vote on Wednesday, which, of course, is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but one of the concerns that I've had over the last couple of years, and even more so this year, is the use of social media to conduct misinformation campaigns. And so, you know, you can imagine one person posts on their Facebook that, you know, the polls have closed, so don't bother, for example, and that going viral in a particular place could do a lot of damage. Now, the other great thing about social media is it also really quickly can combat that with accurate information and get the right information out. But I think that that's something that election administrators and even average citizens need to keep very on top of, because that could really be something that could keep people away.
Tova Andrea Wang is my guest. She's Senior Democracy Fellow at Demos and a Fellow at the Century Foundation. Her new book is called The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the author of the new book, The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. Tova Andrea Wang is Senior Democracy Fellow at Demos and a fellow at the Century Foundation. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have a line open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Tova, I think it's safe to say pretty much no American is in support of lax enforcement of policies that keep people from fraudulently voting. At the same time, we know that there are huge efforts to go after anyone who would try to fraudulently cast a ballot. What kind of conviction rate is there for people who are found to be guilty of spreading misinformation about voting and therefore keeping individuals from exercising their rights to vote?
I know of one. This has actually been, you know, something that has really not been enforced, but I think that that may change. The only case was that I know of was in Maryland, and the John Ehrlich campaign, which was a gubernatorial race a few years ago. Someone associated with their campaign made phone calls to people telling, you know, you don't need to go vote, the election's over, you know, these kinds of things that were targeted but at minorities. And that person actually did get convicted about, I would say, within the last year. You know, it's typically been very difficult to find out who's behind these things. I think it may actually be easier if it's through the Internet sometimes to track people back, but it's very difficult to find out who may be circulating flyers or sending out different things or making phone calls. But, you know, the technology is getting better, so maybe that will change. There also, of course, has to be the will to do that. And I say that with respect to other things, too, such as challenging people at the polls in an intimidating manner or on a racial basis, or, you know, engaging in voter intimidation of any sort, that the Department of Justice as well as state and local law enforcement need to be willing to use the laws that they do have and the tools that they do have to go after these cases. Because, as you said, I mean, that's completely unacceptable in a great democracy such as ours.
So every year people die who have been voting. They move out of their precinct or their state, and therefore voting districts will go ahead and purge names. Talk about this technique called caging and how that relates to the need to remove ineligible voters from the ballot and ultimately sometimes sweeps up eligible voters as well.
Yeah, well, there's sort of a couple of things going on here. There is mandatory under the law, under federal law, that the election administrators keep the voter rolls accurate and up to date by purging them of people who have died and so on. But there are certain limitations around that are meant to protect people from being purged from the list when they shouldn't be. Unfortunately, for some reason this year, several election administrators, including in Texas, I believe, have started going through the process of trying to purge the voter registration list, more particularly to ferret out non-citizens with a few weeks out from the election. So there are a couple of concerns here. First of all, in every single instance of these secretaries of states and others finding and announcing these, you know, thousands of people who are on the rolls and are non-citizens, for example, they end up in every instance backpedaling and whittling it down because they realize that the data matching is just wrong. There are all sorts of inaccuracies in the registration rolls. There are all sorts of inaccuracies in the list that they're using to figure out whether these people are eligible or not. And you end up at the end of the day with a handful of people who may be on the registration list but are, you know, non-citizens or whatever the case may be. Now, that's not evidence that these people have actually voted, of course. It's particularly bizarre to me in the case of non-citizens that that's what they would focus on. I can imagine that in the political climate that we have right now in America around immigrants and immigration, the last thing that someone who's not a citizen wants to do is sign up on an official government document and then go up and announce themselves to a representative of the government on election day is crazy. Though it's committing a felony, they'll go to jail and they'll be deported, you know, all for the purpose of changing one vote. It makes absolutely no sense. And so the other part of it is that, yes, indeed, a lot of people have gotten these letters in the mail saying you have to come to the Board of Elections and prove that you're a citizen. You had to show up at a hearing. And these are people who are perfectly eligible American citizens who have been on the registration list, getting swept up in this last-minute frenzy to purge the voting rolls. And I also really just don't understand why, if this was such a concern, why this kind of activity was not undertaken 6 months ago. Why is it being done a month, 3 weeks out from the election?
Mm-hmm.
So that just makes me a little skeptical.
Are those tactics being universally applied to people who are immigrants? Like, if you're from Canada, are you getting these letters as often as if you're from Mexico and you're a naturalized citizen?
Well, there may be in some cases the matching that they do may disproportionately get people with Latino surnames more ensnared in this than others. But you actually remind me of something kind of humorous, I think. In Florida, you know, they've gone through this whole process as well of trying to purge the voter registration list of anybody who's ineligible and is on the registration list. They have come up with actually one person who was not a citizen and was registered to vote and had actually voted. They found one conviction in all of these cases that they've cited, and he was exactly a Canadian. He was a Canadian man, and he had been posing as an American because he wanted to be able to buy more guns. And so that's what they've netted so far in Florida. It's just, you know, a couple of weeks out from the election, we should be concentrating on ensuring that people are able to participate, that everyone has an equal right to vote, and that, you know, everyone has their say in our government and our democracy, not on this kind of red herring of an issue that is really meant to kind of intimidate and make people nervous and create problems.
We've got lots of people waiting on the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak first with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, also, I thought immigrants may be able to vote in, like, local and state elections. But anyway, the argument that these ALEC supporters like to make is that if one fraudulent vote is cast, it's a travesty. But nobody ever tries the reciprocity. And to say that if one person is disenfranchised, it's a travesty. And I don't understand why that isn't, you know, works both ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, if you want to do just a cold, hard, you know, cost-benefit analysis of the situation, it is so obvious that the number of people who would be disenfranchised by these restrictive voter laws so outweighs the number of people under any analysis who are committing fraud. It's just you can only come to one conclusion. So, you know, that's really an important point that, you know, weighing the balances, it's true. They, you know, where is the outcry about the distortion of the system that happens when people, you know, come to the, even just go to the polls and find themselves not on the registration list and they know that they registered to vote? There are all sorts of situations like that. And just to clarify, there are a couple of towns in the United States that allow immigrants to vote in local elections, but it's only just a few places, and there are no states that do, although that is, you know, another issue.
Let's talk about trimming back early voting periods, which have only been around,
yeah,
at least in Texas, for, I don't know, 15 years or so. People say this is expensive, it's inconvenient, it's really not necessary, but talk about how reducing the availability of early voting makes it harder for some people to vote.
Well, I mean, let me start out by saying that in the first several years of early voting, the findings were in the research that it didn't actually increase turnout very much. It actually just provided a more convenient way to vote for people who would have voted anyway. That started to change over the last several years, over the last 4 or 5 years, where the campaigns have kind of gotten caught on to this and see that they can increase their turnout by getting people to vote early. And in particular, African Americans have overwhelmingly begun to vote early in these elections. And what some of the states, including Florida and Ohio, have tried to do is cut back on early voting, specifically targeting the weekend and the Sunday in particular before Election Day. Now, these legislators who have passed these laws cutting back on the early voting time know very well that it has become a tradition on the Sunday before Election Day for African American churches to, after services, go as a congregation to an early voting site and vote early. And this has amounted to tens of thousands of African Americans going to vote early in states like Florida and Ohio, wholly disproportionate to their numbers in the state. And so those are the days that they targeted for exclusion. And there had not been problems in administering early voting in these places. Voters love it. Administrators like it, too, because it avoids, at least in the best of situations, long lines on election day. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it really is much easier to vote that way because it's not practical for them to have to stand in line on election day in what can be, in some places, hours, when they've got a job, they've got kids, they have other things that they need to do. And so it alleviates the pressure on them. And yet, nonetheless, these governments have decided that they want to get rid of them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Kay is on the line next in Richardson. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I was curious what you guys have to say or what her thoughts are on two things. First was the recent arrest of the Republican official over in, I believe it was Virginia, for allegedly throwing away dozens and dozens, if not more, of voter registration forms filled out voter registration forms. And then also curious what her thoughts are on the alleged connection between some purchased faulty voting machines by the Romney family. And take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, so it turns out after, in 2008, the Republican Party and John McCain, even the presidential candidate, fiercely attacked an organization called Acorn for submitting some registration forms that had fake names on them because they had some rogue workers who were being paid by the form and messed up. And they destroyed the organization. It's gone. And now this year, they have there's a Republican organization, company that the Republican Party has contracted with to do voter registration services. And it turns out that they have been committing the same kind of registration fraud that Acorn was. And now you have this incident with an employee associated with this firm, indeed throwing out voter registration forms. Now, what's also interesting about this is this same firm was used in 2004 and was found to be doing exactly the same thing. They were found to be discarding registration forms filled out by Democrats, and yet, for some reason, in 2012, the Republican Party decided to hire this firm again. And so, they're very quiet, of course, now about this. They've completely distanced themselves, and all of a sudden, nobody's talking about voter registration fraud anymore because, it's this Republican firm that's doing it. This is obviously a blatant case of fraud, and this guy has been, in fact, arrested, I believe. But unfortunately, a lot of the other tactics are a lot more subtle and just on the edges of legality, and those are some of the things that we need to protect against the most. With respect to the voting machines, I've kind of stayed away to some degree from opining on the whole election machine problem. I don't have any doubt that there are problems with machines that malfunction and that there is the potential for voting machines to be manipulated and hacked. I don't think that we have definitive proof of that happening. I don't know where that takes us. And I am always very careful to say that I am by no means a technology person. I'm lucky if I can get my own computer to work. And so I don't feel like I can make an independent judgment on that. But I think that certainly we do want to monitor these voting machines and, look for any kind of outlier results that seem strange and, look into them. I think, we do thankfully have now more machines than ever in the country that do have paper backups because of the great work that a variety of organizations did to push for that around the country to have a paper trail. And so that's somewhat reassuring.
In the interest of being careful and being accurate, I do want to point this out. When you say the Republican Party and you talk about attempts at voter suppression, I can't imagine you're saying that every Republican would support something like this or that it's even a majority. Am I correct about that assessment?
Yeah, I think that it's really the political leadership and not obviously regular people who are creating these situations. But there are some people who are, I suppose, so partisan and so bent on winning that they will engage in these kinds of tactics. And let me just say that I don't think if the roles were reversed, the Democrats would necessarily be any better. Mm-hmm. It's just a sort of demographic reality that you have these groups that are easily identifiable and vote for Democrats. And so, you know, I guess in some people's minds, it makes sense as a strategy to try and, you know, get them not to vote. I don't think that's an acceptable strategy. But as I said, the Democrats used to do it. It's just that, logically speaking, it makes more sense for Republicans to be doing it right now. Maybe that will change. And, you know, some of this is also outside groups, Tea Party-affiliated groups. There's an organization called True the Vote now that there are some concerns about that have been saying the leadership has been saying that there's, you know, all this enormous fraud going on and that they are going to send hundreds of thousands of people to polling sites to challenge people's eligibility. And they've already started challenging people's eligibility on the registration rolls with completely inaccurate data. And so that's also another danger aside from, you know, the officials involved themselves.
We have an email here from John in Oak Cliff who asks, what is sufficient in your view to establish a voter's identity and guard the integrity of a one-person, one-vote system?
Well, you know, up until the last few years, we have required that people mostly in a lot of places just go in, they tell the person their name, they give them their signature, the person compares their signatures, and they go and vote, and it's not been a problem. So that's what I would expect would be a good deal. The Help America Vote Act in 2002 did require that people provide some kind of identifying information or documents when they register for the first time in a jurisdiction, and I think that that's proved to be helpful. So that's also in place to protect against these kinds of problems. So that's what I would advocate.
Tova Andrea Wang is my guest. She's Senior Democracy Fellow at Demos and a fellow at the Century Foundation. Her new book is called The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Tova Andrea Wang, author of The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. You can be part of the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Tova, there's been a lot of discussion in various parts of the country about when the cutoff should be for registering to vote before a particular election. You've suggested that we could really increase participation by allowing people to register on Election Day. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, and I'm really happy to move on to this conversation, which is what I prefer to talk about, which is how we can get more people voting and increase participation and go in a positive direction. So there are now 11 states, actually, that have laws on the book that allow people to register to vote and vote on Election Day or during early voting. And in the states that have had this, and there are a few states that have had it for like 20 years, they every election cycle have the highest rates of turnout of any other state in the country. They surpass other states by double digits. It's really quite extraordinary. It's very helpful for an increasingly mobile society, especially given the economy and, you know, the mortgage crisis. People are increasingly moving around, and for young people who move around a lot. And so we have definitive research that shows that if you had same-day registration throughout the country, we would see an overall increase in voter turnout by 5.7%. And that represents a lot of people. And so, you know, when I was talking earlier about, of course, there are all sorts of reasons why we have people who are very disengaged and very cynical about politics, about government, and understandably so, and that's something that we really need to address. Here's something that we can do, a reform we can enact that will increase participation by a whole lot. With no downside, really. I mean, there, you know, the people will talk again. They'll trot out the fraud argument. But in fact, these states that have had it, some of them, as I said, for many, many years, have experienced no problem with fraud any more than any other state, which is to say extremely little. So this is one of the ways in which we can go in a positive direction and start making it easier for people and being a more inclusive democracy.
What sort of job have we done at facilitating suffrage for active duty service members serving overseas and even U.S. expats working for private companies?
Well, that's so important. You know, I was a strong supporter and am a strong supporter of a recent reform that was passed a couple of years ago called the MOVE Act. One of the provisions of the MOVE Act was that election administrators had to get ballots to people overseas and to the military serving overseas 45 days before the election, because there have been so many problems with the ballots getting to people and then being able to return it in time to be counted in the election. And frankly, the number of ballots that have not been counted from overseas and military voters in the past has been really atrocious. And the participation rates, frankly, are not nearly what they should be for people who are overseas and military voters. So I think that the MOVE Act was a very strong step in the right direction. It did a number of other things as well to make voting easier for people abroad. And I think that we need more to enforce that. And I think the Department of Justice has done a pretty good job, actually, of going after states for not implementing this law properly and not getting those ballots to people within the 45-day time limit. And so I expect that that's, again, the case this year. But I think that that's having a positive impact and that there's more that we could be doing to engage the overseas and military vote.
What does it take for convicted felons who have served their time to be reenfranchised?
Well, so this is a huge issue that, you know, I don't think has been discussed enough in this election. We've been all caught up in the voter ID laws and all these, you know, questions about how many people will be disenfranchised by this, when we actually know for a fact, sitting right here, right now, that there are 6 million people in this country who will not be able to vote on election day because at some time in their lives they committed a felony. And 4.4 million of those people have completely served their time. They've served their time in jail, they've paid their dues, and they are trying to reintegrate into society and rebuild their lives and become part of the American community again. And so I have yet to hear a very persuasive case for why these people who most often have not, you have committed felonies that were not violent and had nothing to do with elections, certainly, being barred from voting. There are a handful of states that essentially bar people who have committed a felony at some times in their lives from ever regaining their voting rights again. And in particular, in Iowa and in Florida, two swing states, of course, they took steps backward in the last 2 years. They made it even more difficult than it had been just prior to regain voting rights for ex-felons. And so there's all sorts of waiting periods that have to go on. You have to individually apply to regain your voting rights by a government board. And even then, you know, you could be waiting for a long time. I know that in Florida, there's a backlog of at least 100,000 people who have, in fact, applied to regain their voting rights, and their applications have yet to be acted upon, with Election Day coming right up. So I think, you know, knowing right now that there are millions of people who, without a doubt, won't be able to vote on Election Day is something that we need to seriously consider going forward, whether that makes any sense at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mark in Arlington. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to know about, in reference to Mitt Romney's son, Tag Romney, purchasing HART, which is one of the top three, there's Sequoia, HART, and ESNS voting machines, which is obviously a problem and a conflict of interest. I mean, you know, families, political dynasties shouldn't be allowed to control our voting machines. I wondered about the recent arrest of the head of ESNS voting machine systems for being a peeping Tom with an 11-year-old girl. I believe it happened 2 weeks ago, obviously a felon. And ESNS used to be called Diebold. It's the same two brothers that own it, the Yusurpovich brothers. And in the video Hacking Democracy on the web, there was actually a lady that went and dumpster dived at Diebold's headquarters and found a check from the Republican National Committee to Diebold. Why are these guys allowed to close down, reopen under another name, and now they're controlling our paper ballot tallying machines, which is the paper trail that's supposed to keep us safe? Isn't this an obvious theft of the election by the Republican Party, if I've ever heard one?
Well, I don't know how familiar you are with the case that Mark cited, Tova, but would you like to comment on that?
Sure. Mark, it sounds like that you know more about the voting machine situation than I do. I am not familiar with the Peeping Tom case. However, I do think that there are conflict of interest rules that should be enacted. And this actually brings up another point. While completely acknowledging, you know, the issues with the voting machines, I don't want anyone to doubt that I think that there are concerns there. I think we should not get overly concerned about that either. But having said that, there are a number of conflicts of interest that should concern us, and I think actually the number one conflict of interest is having partisanly elected election administrators administering our elections. In most of the states in our country, you have an elected Secretary of State, a Republican or a Democrat, setting the rules and implementing the rules and issuing directives and issuing procedures. And they are complete partisans themselves, which sets up a situation where inherently you're going to have people who are suspicious of how they're operating. And then you have, you know, a couple in particular, people, you know, to name names, the secretaries of state in Colorado and Ohio kind of stand out to me as sometimes being pretty blatantly partisan in their jobs. And that raises all sorts of alarms for people. And certainly, I do think that it is a conflict of interest to have any kind of ownership in stake in these companies. But
we don't have the proper laws
in place for dealing with this. And I think we should focus on doing that.
Yeah, I don't even understand why they have private companies that run that. I mean, shouldn't this be a nonpartisan, government-owned operation? Is there really any room for profit?
Well, you know, that's the way it's developed. It's actually the way it's always been. And I think in an ideal world, you're right. I mean, the whole system would be nonpartisan, as it is in many other countries, where they have a commission that is completely nonpartisan, that is, you know, comprised of civil servants who implement the election. But it seems like there's not a whole lot of appetite for making the reforms necessary to do that in our country. But I certainly would love if the discussion would head in the direction of having not having partisanly elected people implementing not only other people's elections, but sometimes overseeing their own elections.
I want to talk about this a little bit. Some people will argue that voter ID laws proposed in this country are no more restrictive than those practiced in a number of other democracies that we in this country respect very much. Can you talk about the differences between the U.S. and, say, India or Canada or several of the countries in Europe?
Absolutely, yeah. So this is actually something I've looked at a lot. There are some countries in the world that do effectively implement a system where there is a national ID card that people present in order to vote. In the places that this works, and it doesn't end up disenfranchising certain groups, for instance, in Latin America, where this is very common, in the places where it does not disenfranchise groups like ethnic minorities and poor people, the governments take enormous resources and spend an enormous amount of money and energy and staff and training in ensuring that every single person in that country, every single eligible voter in that country has that ID card. And so, for example, there are countries in Latin America where election administrators will go to a part of the Amazon that can only be reached by helicopter or boat to get the voter ID card to the 30 people who live in that part of the country. Now, when I'm convinced, and I'm honest about this, and I'm serious. When I am convinced that we are in a position in this country where the federal government is going to undertake a huge federally government-run program to ensure that every single person in this country has the type of ID they need to vote, then I'd be very happy to talk about requiring that ID in order to vote. But what they're doing now is they're cherry-picking, and they're allowing some types of ID to be acceptable and some not. And the ones that they're choosing to make acceptable are ones that happen to be documents that certain groups of people don't have, and that's what's so unfair.
Mm-hmm. What about younger voters who have not yet voted, not yet registered to vote, but could, in fact, make a difference in an election for either party? How do we get them engaged?
That's, you know, a great question. And again, making it easier rather than harder for young people to vote can make a difference. Again, you know, it's going to take the candidates, it's going to take the politics of the situation and so on to get people engaged. But, you know, again, same-day registration is something that has been hugely beneficial to young people because they move around so much. Colleges and universities are starting to become more actively engaged in getting young people registered to vote. And I think at the end of the day, though, it will really take politicians, candidates, the parties, talking about young people's issues. People want to be asked for their vote, and they want to hear what the people who are running have to say about issues that they care about. And it's become a bit of a vicious cycle because, you know, in the past, young people have not voted, so candidates ignore them and candidates ignore them, and so they don't vote. And so it's been a bit of a vicious cycle. But I think it's, you know, it's sort of incrementally improving. The youth vote has gone up incrementally over the last several election cycles, and I do hope that, again, young people will vote out and vote in big numbers this year, if for no other reason that they have been targeted for denial of the right to vote. And I hope that young people do what young people do is, you know, when they're told that they can't do something, then they want to do it even more. And mm-hmm. So that will inspire them, in fact, to get out there.
Do you find that in addition to young people, members of other sort of targeted groups are aware of this and are actively fighting back? Or is it a case of not even realizing that there may be something standing in the way of their right to vote?
I think young people may not know as much, but I will tell you that African-Americans and Latinos, African-Americans in particular, having been down this road too many times, mm-hmm. are extremely aware. And there are counter efforts being undertaken that are truly amazing. And, you know, in the states where voter ID laws have passed, now, mind you, a lot of those voter ID laws have been struck down by the courts and will not be implemented, including in Texas. So in Texas, this will not be in place in 2012. But there are all sorts of efforts going on to ensure that as many people as possible can get the ID that they need. In some cases, it's really kind of not possible, but where it is, getting, you know, driving people to the DMVs, helping them financially to be able to get their birth certificates. And I think there is a growing anger among a lot of people at, you know, what something that is really subversive of democracy, and people, I think, are becoming very attuned to it. And in fact, even in the general population, the voter ID law is on the ballot this year in Minnesota, and the polls have been actually moving incredibly. It used to be overwhelmingly people were in favor of passing the voter ID law by ballot this year, and now it's almost 50-50 as people have come to learn the facts around this issue and understood that this is a form of vote denial that is not addressing a real problem.
The new book by Tova Andrea Wang is called The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. Tova, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington, with help today from Lindsay Connect. Learn more about upcoming programs and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.